Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Standing outside Chicago's Museum of Science and Industry, President Bush today reiterated his support for a firm but diplomatic response to North Korea's long-range missile testing.
All of us said, don't fire that rocket. He not only fired one, he fired seven. Now, he made that defiance. It's best for all of us to go to the U.N. Security Council and say loud and clear, here are some red lines. And that's what we're in the process of doing.
At his news conference in Chicago, the president also addressed the economy, immigration, and gasoline prices. His appearance is part of a new presidential push to spend more time in local communities, talking to voters before November's critical midterm elections, which will determine whether the Republicans can maintain control of the House and Senate. Joining us to discuss the news conference is Rick Klein, Washington correspondent for the Boston Globe. Hi, Rick.
Hi there.
Rick, let's start with North Korea, which the president didn't mention in his opening remarks, but it was the first question he answered. He said he was willing to be patient, saying diplomacy takes time.
You know, the problem with diplomacy, it takes a while to get something done. If you're acting alone, you can move quickly. When you're rallying world opinion and trying to, you know, come up with the right language at the United Nations to send a clear signal, it takes a while.
That language, Rick, is certainly in contrast to the more aggressive president we saw in the run-up to the war in Iraq. Why the subtler message this time? Is he trying to come across as more moderate?
Well, I think he basically has to after everything that's transpired with Iraq. And I think if he tries to push too hard on the United Nations, there'll be a big backlash both at the UN and domestically. And I think the experience with Iraq has really given him little option other than to be patient with this. And it was an interesting contrast because he a couple of times expressed frustration with the pace. It was clear that he would like to be moving faster on the diplomatic front, but he said several times that he thinks that a diplomatic solution through the United Nations, through the six-party talks, will ultimately resolve the standoff.
And I noticed that he avoided the question, the military option question.
Yes, entirely. He was asked it a few different ways, and each time he said, look, diplomacy is always the first option. At one point he said, you know, any American president has to exhaust any and all diplomatic options, and he went through a long explanation of the diplomatic approach that fell short, obviously, in resolving the standoff with Saddam Hussein.
To the home front, the first thing the president talked about was the economy, trumpeting the 120,000 new jobs created in June, as reported today. But just hours earlier, economists had been predicting an increase of more than double that number. And I'm wondering, do conflicting numbers like that make it tough for the president to get his message through that the economy is humming along?
Well, of course, yeah, they definitely do, and a point the Democrats will make is that this isn't even really keeping pace with the number that you'd need to just maintain current employment levels given natural population growth. I think even more than the numbers, the problem that the president and Republicans in Congress have in describing the economy this year is that people, for whatever reason, do not feel like the economy is doing very well. There hasn't been a huge increase in wages that even to go along with the strength of the economy. Obviously, gas prices are an enormous factor in that as well. People are frustrated every time they have to fill up their cars, and of course, lots of other consumer goods are more expensive because of gas prices as well. So I think it's something that the Republicans do believe, including the president, that the economy is a source of strength. But they're having a very difficult time communicating that.
Let's stay on the gas price issue. He was asked about the high price of gas in polls, which show that people are not satisfied with leadership in Washington on the issue and dealing with the issue. In response, the president, in a way, threw those concerns back at citizens.
If people are generally concerned about the price of gasoline, they ought to be supporting my initiative to encourage the construction of additional refinery capacity. It's not the long-term solution, but it's an important solution for the short run.
Just a minute left, Rick. Politically speaking, when he challenges people who are having a hard time paying at the pump and all the rest of the bills because they're paying so much at the pump, how does that help him politically?
I can't imagine that being a very effective message. I mean, the way the congressional Republicans try to pitch that is to say, look, the Democrats are standing in the way of all of these things we do to lower gas prices. But I don't think that, you know, anything that smells of blaming consumers for the price of gas is something that's going to really fly with people. This is a huge liability for Republicans this year. I mean, potentially a bigger issue than the war in Iraq or the issues with North Korea or Iran is gas prices, because it's something that hits people in their pocketbooks every day, all the time. And I think Republicans realize this is a liability. They're trying to find some traction for an effective counter message, but it really is an extremely difficult problem.
Rick Klein, Washington correspondent for the Boston Globe. Thanks.
Thank you.
If you're looking for news from Africa, you may have to dig to get it. Last October, the Harper's Index reported that the number of combined minutes in 2005 CBS and NBC spent reporting on the humanitarian crisis in Darfur was 8 minutes. So it's no wonder the image many Americans have of Africa is of emaciated children, amputee victims of civil wars, child soldiers in flip-flops, etc. But there's more to the story, so writes Charlene Hunter-Galt, the Emmy and Peabody Award-winning journalist who's lived in Africa since 1997. Her new book, New News Out of Africa, Uncovering Africa's Renaissance, digs beneath the headlines for what she believes is a more nuanced view of a complicated continent. Charlene Hunter-Galt, thanks for coming in, and it's nice to meet you.
Thank you for having me.
You make the point in the introduction to the book that little good news about Africa gets through to Americans. Why do you think that's the case?
I think that there is a perception among those who decide what gets covered and gets into the media that people in America aren't interested in Africa, which in my own experience is just the opposite. I mean, everywhere I go, I'm getting a great reception to this book. People are saying, oh, finally, I'm so glad to see some other news about Africa than, you know, war and conflict. People are interested in because they turn out. Huge crowds come to hear me talk about Africa. But the questions often are just bordering on being embarrassing. In a university audience, a man in a herringbone three-piece suit asked me, are there skyscrapers in Africa? There is a woeful lack of information across the board, not only in the media, but in the textbooks, in the history books. And, you know, I'm hoping that New News Out of Africa will fill a little bit of that void.
Is part of the problem that some nations in Africa have, in a sense, brought upon themselves in terms of creating a credibility problem and an image problem for themselves, liberation to despotic leaders, not tolerating dissent, rigging elections, emasculating the courts, cowing the press? It's not a favorable image.
Well, first of all, let me say two things about that. Number one, the United States had a lot to do with helping those despots remain in power. As long as they stood as bulwarks against communism, like Mobutu Sese Seko and others, the United States supported them, and they could do whatever they wanted to do, including that long list of awful things you just mentioned, and the United States in those days would not intervene. In the 1960s, British Prime Minister Harold Macmillan talked about a new wind of change blowing across the continent, and he was talking about the beginning of independence. And for some of the reasons I just cited, and for other reasons, a lot of that led to a dead end. Today, there is a second wind blowing across the continent. And it's the African people, including the leadership as well as the media, are beginning now to set up systems and to set up programs and policies that call despots and tyrants to account. There's this new African Union, well, new several years now, which took the place of the Organization of African Unity. And they've actually set up mechanisms to judge the practices of countries, which is revolutionary. It's so far relatively untested, but increasing numbers of African countries are signing on to having prominent citizens like Grasa Machel and others come in and look at their practices, their governance, their adherence to human rights. It's things like this that need to be encouraged, which is all the more reason why we should have more reporting from Africa so that the international community can ensure what I call these first baby steps towards democracy, can help promote it.
Are you optimistic along those lines in terms of getting the international community to focus more on Africa? There still aren't many American reporters there. You're one of three NPR reporters.
Right. And CNN has is starting to beef up its presence on the continent. And yet none of the major networks have permanent people there. You know who's doing the best job on raising important issues in Africa right now? Hollywood. I mean, you know, The Constant Gardener is a wonderful movie. I mean, I was just in Nigeria, and the headlines in the newspaper were about a pharmaceutical company which came in and did experiments with young children.
Unannounced?
Well, the pharmaceutical company insists that the Nigerian government knew what they were doing and were accountable to them. There's been some dispute about that. But some of these children actually died. And this is happening around the continent. So here is a great movie. And also, likewise, Lord of War. I mean, you know, dealing with the arms trade. But again, I'm saying let's have balanced reporting because it's not all good. There is death, disease, as we see in the front page of the New York Times in recent days about malaria. But hey, guess how come malaria it continues to rage in Africa? The New York Times reported not long ago that the World Bank pledged to have malaria deaths in Africa cut in half 6 years ago, and its staff working on the disease is down to zero. Why haven't we known about that? So you parachute in when something erupts, and then you leave.
There's constantly, not only in Africa but around the world, a lot of finger pointing when it comes to aid, the commitment of aid, the delivery of aid. A year ago, the Group of Eight summit pledged to double aid to Africa to $50 billion U.S. dollars. There were arguments about how the aid never makes it to the people and keeps despots in power. Where are you on that?
Well, I think there's some truth to that. But when Carol Bellamy, the head of UNICEF, was on her farewell tour of Southern Africa, she had something to say about that. She said, we shouldn't be punishing the people for the actions and behavior of their leaders. It's sort of like the debt issue. There are many who argue that there should be debt relief in African countries because a lot of this debt was incurred during the time when despots were taking advantage of the people and robbing them. And now there's a generation of people who had nothing to do with that who are being punished by having to pay the debt. They call that odious debt. And you do have, this is one of the, some of the new news in Africa, that there is a growing, energized civil society that is trying to indeed bring about an African renaissance.
Charlaine Hunter-Galt's new book is New News Out of Africa, Uncovering Africa's Renaissance. When we come back, a look at the successes and failures of the new South Africa. There's more coming up here and now. Our conversation with journalist Charlaine Hunter-Galt continues. She was CNN's Johannesburg bureau chief during the transition from apartheid in South Africa and has lived in Johannesburg since 1997. She says her new book, New News Out of Africa, Uncovering Africa's Renaissance, is an attempt to balance the reporting on Africa. You write that one of the great success stories is South Africa's program to distribute free antiretrovirals to people with AIDS and medication to help pregnant women with HIV. Two of the world's richest men, Bill Gates and now also Warren Buffett, are committing billions of dollars, and billions, I should say, to philanthropic work, some of which will certainly make its way to public health efforts in Africa. And I'm wondering what impact you think it'll have.
I think potentially it will have a great impact. I mean, one thing I can say about Bill and Melinda Gates, I've seen that they've been there. They go there. They meet the people. They get to know them. And so there's a real, I have a real hope that their efforts will stimulate others to join with them, because poverty is the number one problem in Africa, and it is massive. I just did this 5-part series for NPR, and no matter what you look at, whether you, infant mortality, maternal mortality, it all somehow is about poverty. And it has so many dimensions. I mean, even if you just look at girls' education, one of the reasons that girls drop out of primary school, even though even in countries where they've achieved parity with boys, they drop out because the toilets are pit latrines, and often, you know, encased with mud, and girls are reluctant to go and do what they have to do with everybody standing around watching. And
right.
So they drop out.
To be
out
blunt,
of,
no place to sit down.
No place to sit down. And, you know, it's a little more complicated for a girl than a boy. But it leads to them dropping out. So, I mean, even if you could build decent toilets in some places, let alone decent schools, you would retain more girls. But you have to go there to know there. I've been in Africa for 10 years, and this poverty series that I've done just opened my eyes to so many more things. So as long as the Gates people continue as they have, which is to involve local people in coming up with their own solutions, that the ultimate objective is not only to do something about poverty, but to empower the people, there could be real progress made.
Let me shift gears and let's talk about post-apartheid South Africa. In the book, you talk about the success, although imperfect success, I think, as you call it, of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in surfacing crimes and helping the transition in that country. The process is being repeated in other countries now, and in some cases, it's being called an easy out for war crimes. Do you see that point, and why did it work in South Africa?
First of all, South Africa made a transition from a decades-long, horribly oppressive regime relatively peacefully, not without some giving up some things. Many of those people who committed heinous crimes are walking around the streets of South Africa today not having either come forward and told the truth about what they did, which is what the Truth Commission was about, or even acknowledged that the Truth Commission existed. And even those high-level officials who testified lied. And so people have essentially gotten away with murder. The trade-off was that the country remained stable. In Africa, ancestors, it's a very important dimension to life, to be able to go to the graves and talk to the ancestors, to know where the bodies are buried, to go and make pilgrimages, more or less. And many people do not know what happened to their loved ones. I mean, many of them were barbecued by the regime. In the Truth Commission, some who testified talked about how they roasted a person on a spit. Many of them were thrown out of helicopters into the sea. Many of them were murdered and buried in unmarked graves. And the relatives are saying, okay, we don't really care anymore about the truth. We just want the bones of our loved ones. So this lingering lack of closure has been the downside of the commission. And even Archbishop Desmond Tutu, one of the major moral voices of the country who headed the Truth Commission, has acknowledged the imperfections of it.
So let me ask you then, a little more than 10 years after liberation, in your view, is South Africa fulfilling Nelson Mandela's dream?
I think there are always going to be conflicts when you have multiracial, multiethnic societies, but South Africa has made tremendous strides in redressing the imbalances of the past. Not perfect, but it is the strongest democracy on the continent, and it is fueling the regeneration of the rest of the continent. So it's important, again, for the international community not only to remain engaged in the whole continent, but to remain particularly engaged in South Africa, because if South Africa succeeds, the chances of the rest of the continent are greatly enhanced. If South Africa doesn't succeed, we don't even want to go there.
You've now lived in South Africa, in Johannesburg, for almost 10 years. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
You're staying?
Well, I've become a permanent resident, so I have residences in South Africa and in the United States, and I love both of these countries. I mean, to be a witness to the kind of history that is taking place in South Africa is a, for me, it's a dream of a lifetime of reporting. It's still a dynamic environment. I'm reliving some of the things that happened in my own country in the South. But South Africa is moving at such an accelerated pace. And also, you know, to witness the difference between how a black-led government with a black-led majority deals with past discrimination and redress, where affirmative action is not a dirty word but government policy. I mean, and where, if their black economic empowerment project succeeds, it will result in the most radical economic transformation in our lifetimes. That is new news that I want to report.
And we'll be hearing more about that down the road from Charlene Hunter Gault. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for those great questions.
Charlene Hunter Gault's new book is New News Out of Africa, Uncovering Africa's Renaissance. Her five-part series on poverty in Africa airs on NPR this summer. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where
Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has been getting a lot of press following his article in Rolling Stone magazine last month, alleging that the presidential election of 2004 was stolen. The son of liberal icon Bobby Kennedy claimed that one in every 100 votes cast nationwide in 2004 was spoiled by malfunctioning equipment, and that 357,000 votes were affected in Ohio alone, where he alleges there was also some outright fraudulent shifting of votes from Democrat John Kerry to George Bush. All told, enough, he says, to cost Kerry the election. Much has been written in the past month discrediting RFK Jr.'s stolen election theory, with some experts and pundits from both sides of the aisle saying his use of fact was selective and distorting. But the controversy has not died down because of ongoing election systems problems, once again in Ohio, and continued hardball politics being played there by desperate-to-win Democrats and Republican incumbents in some of the most contested races in the nation. Joining us on the line from Washington is correspondent Andrew Gumbel, who's written an article called "The Coming Ballot Meltdown" for the current issue of The Nation magazine. Welcome, Andrew.
Pleasure to be here.
Let me first of all ask you to address the RFK Jr. stolen election theory first. What do you make of the claim?
I agree with the point of view that his use of material is very selective and very partisan, and in my view is all designed to bolster a predetermined outcome, which is to argue that Kerry was the rightful winner of the election. I think there's a lot of very good stuff there that then gets distorted by the presentation. To take a couple of examples, there's a lot in that article about exit polls, which showed the possibility of Kerry coming out ahead, and RFK Jr.'s argument is that the exit polls were essentially correct, and that it was the final outcome that was wrong. In there, he quotes experts on polls saying that there was something very wrong with the exit poll, which indeed I believe there was too. What he doesn't say is a lot of those experts actually don't happen to believe that the outcome was wrong. And I think it's a huge tactical blunder to insist that the outcome in Ohio was wrong. Because if you keep saying Bush didn't win, Bush didn't win, Bush didn't win, you are automatically turning off probably all Republicans and very possibly a large number of Democrats who don't buy that argument, who then say, well, the people who say that there's something wrong with our electoral system are essentially, you know, marginal people and crackpots, and why should we take them seriously? Whereas I think there are a very large number of issues that must be taken very seriously in terms of, you know, untransparent practices, voting machines that don't work, capricious partisan rulings by the Secretary of State in Ohio and in other states, and on and on and on. A lot of the problems that RFK Jr. highlights, but I believe distorts because he wants to come to a predetermined conclusion.
All right, well, let's talk about your article. You write about the coming ballot meltdown in Ohio and that, in your prediction, all hell could break loose there in November. Why do you say that, and what do you mean?
The main reason I say that is because the man running for governor on the Republican ticket is currently the Secretary of State,
Kenneth Blackwell,
who is responsible for the electoral system. And in 2004, he issued a series of rulings that looked to absolutely everybody to be nakedly partisan in character. He denied it, regarding the management of provisional voting, absentee voting, how people should register to vote, what kind of paper they needed to register to vote on, all of which seemed like vote-suppressing mechanisms against Democrats primarily. In this election cycle, he's added again. He's just issued a very restrictive ruling about the registering of voters by get-out-the-vote groups like ACORN, which is a nonpartisan community group, and others. And it's had a chilling effect already. They've suspended their registration drives until they've consulted with their lawyers to make sure they're not going to be liable for felony offenses, et cetera, et cetera. So he's not regarded in Ohio or anywhere else as being an honest broker of the electoral system, and now he's got his own political ambitions to defend in what looks like is going to be a very close race.
We should probably remind everyone here that Blackwell was the state chairman of the Bush campaign in Ohio in 2004. But let me ask you this question. Isn't everything Blackwell is doing legal?
Yes, it probably is. I mean, that conflict of interest you talked about, being able to represent a campaign in a state and also be responsible for the fairness of the system, there's no rule that says you can't do that. Catherine Harris had the same role in Florida in 2000. And likewise, there's no rule that says you can't be in charge of the election system for your own election.
Let me ask you this question. How do you think some of the issues you identify, including new electronic voting machines run by inexperienced poll workers in Ohio, the new law that requires voters to have IDs, higher fees for recounts, how do you think that's going to affect voting itself in November?
Well, what's very depressing is Ohio is not a state like Florida, which has a long tradition of malfeasance and corruption. It's a state which has a reputation essentially for being, you know, honest and fair and open, you know, all those good Midwestern values. However, it's also a state where one party, turns out it's the Republicans, have been in control for a very long time, essentially for the last 12 years. You can measure it different ways, where they've, you know, run the state legislature, they've had the run of the governor's office and other statewide offices. And that has engendered a tremendous amount of corruption, a lot of which has been written about. And a lot of those officials have taken a very keen interest in the election office, and they've played hardball in the election office in terms of negotiating the kinds of rules you're talking about, whether it's rules for coming to polling stations, what people have to bring, and there are various implications for Republicans or Democrats based on what people know of the kind of people who tend to vote for one party or the other.
Is there much concern or anger among voters in Ohio about all this stuff?
Relatively little. You know, one of the things that's true across the country is I think people still want to believe their system is strong and in good shape. And in some states where there is specific knowledge, for instance, in California where I live, you know, you've got a tremendous amount of computer science knowledge because of Silicon Valley and so on. So you have a large number of reputable computer scientists who've looked at the software of these new electronic voting machines and say, it doesn't work, or it's unaccountable, or you know, we need to have better certification processes, or whatever it is. In Ohio, that very little of that has happened, and because of the deeply partisan nature of the 2004 election, in particular, what progress had been made before the 2004 campaign vanished into the ether. And since 2004, you've had a number of statewide rulings and new laws that have heavily favored the Republicans, essentially. You mentioned one or two of them, the requirement for voter ID, the fact that it's now much harder to have recounts because they've removed the audit requirement on the new electronic machines, and they've also increased the cost of demanding a recount in places where they still use paper systems. All these things have given the Republican little inbuilt advantages, and they've also made the system less transparent. So the nightmare scenario is essentially you have a system where the playing field is not level. It's been tilted by the Republicans because they happen to be in power now. And if there's a dispute, there's going to be no way of really easily resolving it because the system has become completely opaque, and I would argue deliberately so.
So, Andrew, bottom line, what do you expect will happen in November in Ohio? Meltdown, or can chaos be averted?
It depends a little bit on the margins of victory. There's this, you know, elemental battle going on between the Republicans who've been in control for a long time but have tainted by corruption, and the Democrats who are desperate to take as many offices away from them as possible. If a lot of those races are close, in that kind of environment of, you know, zero accountability, overwhelmed poll workers by new machinery, and all the other problems, then you've got a recipe for disaster.
Andrew Gumbel is the U.S.-based correspondent for the London newspaper The Independent. His article, The Coming Ballot Meltdown, appears in the current issue of The Nation. Still to come, using modern geometry to explain the structure of Western music, you're listening to Here and Now. One team is called Les Bleus, the other is called Azzurri, but both mean blue in English. It's France and Italy, and they're getting ready to fight it out on Sunday for the World Soccer Championship. World Cup fever has been running high all over the globe. Even America's caught a bit of it this time around. The home team, Germany, suffered a crushing defeat, and the perennial powerhouse Brazil was knocked out in the quarterfinals. It's been a month of high drama, and here with us to talk about it is Franklin Foer, editor of The New Republic and author of How Soccer Explains the World, an unlikely theory of globalization. Hi, Frank.
Hi.
Give us some of your favorite moments so far in the month of World Cup soccer.
One of the great moments came with France in the quarterfinals when they knocked off Brazil. Brazil had been, by most accounts, the overwhelming favorite to win the tournament. And they were a team just loaded with stars. And France was a team that had been playing relatively poorly throughout the tournament. And part of the reason that they've been playing poorly is that they were a team of kind of aging veterans and who didn't look like they were holding up all that well in the summer heat. And then in this quarterfinal match against Brazil, they suddenly played out of their minds and just dominated the overdog. And the shining story of that match was a player named Zinedine Zidane, who is 34 years old and was really one of the great players of his generation, who has promised to retire not just from international soccer, but from the sport full stop after this tournament. And he played an incredibly brilliant game against Brazil.
Tell us about Italy, which had an especially long journey and some disgrace to overcome.
Right. Well, Italy is going through incredibly humiliating and massive scandal in its professional league right now, where there's all sorts of allegations of match fixing and manipulation of refereeing, and a lot of the teams that the Italian players play for on a day-in and day-out basis in the year might be kicked out of the top division of Italian soccer. It's hard to overstate the magnitude of the scandal. And counterintuitively, this scandal seems to have brought the Italian club together. There is a desire among the players to redeem the game. But there's also a more mercenary component to their high level of play during this tournament. A lot of players are using this tournament as basically an advertising window to show off their services to prospective buyers.
And the French team at least looks a little more international in its makeup, whereas the Italian team looks Italian.
Well, that's right. I mean, the Italian team is drawn exclusively from the Italian domestic league, whereas the French team is comprised largely of the sons of immigrant families from Africa.
Frank, tell us again about your theory of political systems and the soccer teams they produce. And have the games proved you right? Should France and Italy have been in the final match as they are?
My theory went something like this. Social democracies, and especially social democracies residing within the European Union, have the most consistent record of producing World Cup winners. And, you know, I got to say that events have vindicated my my theory in the most triumphant way, because here we have two great social democracies going at it in this tournament.
Okay, so can you predict whether the cranky democracy of France or the great democracy in constant turmoil in Italy will triumph in the game on Sunday?
Unfortunately, I didn't slice the ideological salami quite so thin as that. But if you ask me on a personal basis, I'm pulling for France, but I've got to say that I think that Italy has a lot of advantages in this tournament.
So then no matter how it comes out on Sunday, you really can't lose in terms of your prediction.
Oh, that's right. No, I'm going to be vindicated pretty much no matter what. That's the beauty of a non-fossil viable theory.
Franklin Foer, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Franklin Foer is editor of The New Republic and author of How Soccer Explains the World, an Unlikely Theory of Globalization. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. of years, music and mathematics have been linked, from the ancient philosopher Pythagoras to the 20th century composer Philip Glass, who majored in math at the University of Chicago. But as composer and music theorist Dimitri Tomasko shows in a paper this week in the journal Science, mathematics and music share more than just a link. In fact, mathematics, in particular modern geometry, can actually be used to explain the structure of Western music. It's the first music theory paper in the journal's 127-year history. Here and Now's Alan Cockle spoke with Dimitri Tomasko to find out more.
Early European classical music was essentially melodic, a single voice or a choir rising and falling together, one note at a time. Then in the late Middle Ages, something else happened. Melodies began to play against each other in counterpoint, and the result was harmony. It added a whole new dimension to the music, and from a mathematical point of view, made it much more complex.
This is a C major chord, and it sounds fairly similar to this chord, which is an F major chord.
Dimitri Tomasko is a composer and music theorist at Princeton University and at the Radcliffe Institute in Cambridge.
So, the first sort of principle that's common to many musical styles is that you want to use chords that are audibly similar and get a nice, consistent sound.
He's been studying the interplay of the two major domains of Western music, harmony and counterpoint, or the way music moves from one combination of notes to the next.
The second principle is that you want to move from chord to chord while minimizing physical effort. So if you're a pianist, you don't want to have to move all over the keyboard as you move from one chord to another. Or if you're a singer, you don't want to sing da-dee or something like that. You want to sing da-dee.
Musically, this is a very old idea, moving from one similar-sounding chord to another while minimizing the physical effort. What Tomasko has now done is to develop a way to represent these chord progressions through math, and to do it, he used geometry. So what's the geometry of music? Well, you could think of a piano keyboard as a line of notes, or you could think of it as a circle, with each octave coming back around to the top.
That will bring us back to do,
So a three-note chord could be represented as 3 points on a circle. But Tomasko says that still doesn't leave you a way to tell similar-sounding chords apart.
So if I can play a series of different keys on the piano that all sound somewhat like a C major chord. For instance, and what Western musical notation doesn't do is elegantly depict the similarity that all three of those chords possess. And so what I did in my paper is find a geometrical space in which the musical similarities that we naturally respond to are depicted in a very clear and elegant way.
His elegant geometry goes beyond the three-dimensional world that we're familiar with to an exotic, higher-dimensional geometry. It makes for graceful computer movies in which the chords of, say, a Chopin prelude appear as floating balls moving fluidly inside a pyramid-like space. The Chopin is a famous piece of music, but Tomasko says it's always baffled music theorists who to this day don't agree on how its unusual chord progressions work. But within his geometry, the piece makes perfect sense.
If you look at this piece using these new geometrical representations, you can see that it's incredibly systematic. And in fact, Chopin is following a very systematic trajectory through the four-dimensional space that contains four-note chords.
The geometry works for all chord-based Western music, from Baroque to modern jazz, and it also works for 20th century atonal music. Richard Cohn, a professor of music at Yale University, calls Tomasko's work sensational. Cohn says earlier efforts to map chords have either been incomplete or have failed to group all like chords together.
He has now a map that is both comprehensive, that is, every conceivable chord is on it, and it's also complete in the sense that any two chords that we perceive as close are actually close on the map.
Dimitri Tomasko uses computers to aid his own compositions, including the piece we're hearing now. But will his new geometry ever allow musicians to generate new chord progressions with the power to make an audience weep? The composer says no.
It's very hard to write really good music, and it takes talent and a lot of work, and no amount of geometry is going to make up for that. On the other hand, if you want to go from writing not very good music to pretty good music, having a systematic understanding of the space of musical possibilities is really helpful.
Over 1,000 years, Western music has moved from melody to chords, Gregorian chant to classical to modern to jazz, and Dmitri Tomasko hopes his new math will show that these traditions are more alike than different.
Here and Now's Alan Cockle with music composer and theorist Dmitri Tomasko. For more information, visit our website, here-now.org. And finally, we have one more musical note. Last week, we brought you a story on the search for a new national anthem for Scotland. More than 10,000 people from around the world voted to pick the winner in an online poll held by the Royal Scottish National Orchestra. And the winner is Flower of Scotland, which beat out four other candidates with 41% of the vote. The song was written by the late Roy Williams over 30 years ago and commemorates the 1314 Battle of Bannockburn. A final adoption of Flower of Scotland as the official anthem is still up to politicians, but in the meantime, we thought we'd let you hear the People's Choice again. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Bob Oakes, in for Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Bob Oakes. Join us next time for the news and